We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. WILLPLEDGE.ORG. Now here's your program.
And we're glad to have you with us this morning. The producers for our show, Harriet Williams and Martha Deal, Henry Frain is at the controls. Before we get underway with this hour of the show, I'd like to take just about a minute or two to remind you that this is one of the times during the year that we sit in front of the microphones and we encourage you to support the station. And when I say support, I don't mean moral support, I mean financial support. This is a listener-supported station, and this is our spring fundraising effort. And we're here to raise money in the hope that we'll be able to keep going and pay for the programs that you enjoy all through the year. We're raising the money that we will spend in the next fiscal year. And as we discussed a little earlier this morning, the end of the fiscal year is approaching pretty quickly. It ends on June 30th. So we want to make sure that we have the money in the bank that will pay for next year's programming. And that is why we're sitting here in front of the microphone urging you to call 244-9455, or to go online to our pledge site, that's willpledge.org, and make a financial contribution to the station. Certainly, you have heard about the kind of budget crisis that we're having here in the state of Illinois. That has a direct effect on the university, and that ultimately affects us. In fact, we have seen some cuts in some direct funding that we previously got from the state of Illinois, and things don't look terribly rosy as we look to the near future. The state funding has continued to erode. The federal funding has continued to erode. We have one alternative, and that is to go to listeners and say to you, if you value programs like Focus and All Things Considered and Afternoon Magazine and Morning Edition and everything you hear on this station, if these shows are important to you, we hope that you will help pay just a part of the cost of producing the shows. That's up to you. You can decide how much you would like to contribute. What we hope that you will do, however, is make the decision to be a contributor. And as I said, it's real easy. It will take just a couple of minutes. A lot of people now, more and more people are doing it online. So you can go to willpledge.org or you can call us at 244-9455. 217 is the area code, and we would be very happy to accept your pledge. Well, this is Focus. It's our morning talk program. Glad to have you with us. This week, beginning tomorrow and Saturday, some of the most important scholars of Islam will be coming here to the University of Illinois for an international symposium that will explore Islamic views on salvation. This morning, in this hour of Focus, we will be talking with one of the people who will be coming here for this conference. His name is Bruce Lawrence, and he is professor at Duke University. He's professor of religion there. He's also the associate director of the Duke Islamic Studies Center, and is someone who has been writing about Islam and talking about Islam for quite a long time. We're pleased that he could be with us just to spend a little bit of time to talk. This conference is, of course, open to people who are interested. And one of the reasons we like to do programs like this is just to let people know about events that are going on in the community. But also at the same time, it gives us an opportunity to talk about the issues raised in them and then also to go a little bit beyond that. So that is what we hope that we will do here for this part of the program. Questions, of course, from people who are listening are welcome. 333-9455 and also toll-free. 800-222-9455. In addition to that, those two numbers, we do have the email. You can email us at will-talk@illinois.edu. So at any point here, you'd like to be involved in the conversation, you're certainly welcome to do that. Professor Lawrence, hello.
Hello. Good to be with you, David.
Well, thank you very much for talking with us. We certainly appreciate it. I hope we can raise some questions here that not only will be interesting for you to talk about, but will also connect with the conference that's going on here.
Well, I'm sure they will. I'm looking forward to it.
I thought that really the thing to try to hone in on is something like this. Within majority Muslim societies, what is the way that – how do people think about the role of faith, of religion, in what sort of role it should have in the public square, you know, how it is it informs their political participation. And then perhaps going on from that to talk about how it is that that's a between the Islamic world and the West, that often is where there's a disconnect. But not to go too far here with the first question, maybe we can talk a little bit about, well, what for people who are Muslims, how do they think about the role of their faith in, as we would say, in the public square?
Well, it's a major question. It's a question that comes up for everyone who is both Muslim and citizen. And so the title of my paper is Citizen Ahmed, because Ahmed is a distinctly Muslim as well as a Muslim male name. And my argument is that there isn't a country in the world. There may be regions, but there are no country in the world where Muslims live that they aren't also not just believers, peoples of faith, but also citizens of a particular structure, a particular polity. And it really matters how they're considered and how they consider others in this public domain or what's sometimes called the public square. So the answer is, even if you were to go, and let me just say there's a spectrum of Muslim societies, like there is a spectrum of non-Muslim societies in the world. So, you know, one could say it's not the same being a Muslim in, let's say, Saudi Arabia as it is being a Muslim in Turkey. I mean, they're both countries with majority Muslim populations, but it's very different if I were to ask the question which you directly put, the role of religion, or the role in this case of Islam in public square, to a Saudi, as distinct from somebody who's a contemporary Turkish citizen, you'd get different responses. So let me just assume that you or your questioner or audience would be interested in the difference. In the case of the Saudi Arabia, it is not just a Muslim country, but it's also the center for the two holiest places in Islam, Mecca and Medina, both on the Red Sea coast, in the middle region of Saudi Arabia, and both of those are places that all Muslims in the world acknowledge as important. And Saudi Arabia, in the sense of its role in Islam, is not just a state or a nation state, but it's also the liturgical center. It is the point of orientation for all those who are Muslim. So, in a certain sense, being a citizen in Saudi Arabia means, first of all, you have to be Muslim. There's no non-Muslim. So the first thing to say about Saudi Arabia is the public square is not just a place where Muslims participate. It's a place reserved for Muslims only. Mm-hmm. Of course, there are non-Muslims who live in Saudi Arabia, but they don't live there as citizens. In other words, there are no people who are Christians, Jews, Hindus, Buddhists, or secularists, at least in the religious label, in Saudi Arabia. If you skip up the coast and across to Turkey, you have a very different situation, where Turkey has been part of a history that links it to Europe and links it also to parts of Asia, including Russia. And Turks have included over the centuries many people who are non-Muslim in their larger polity, or their when they were an empire. It was an empire, and now it's a nation state. So in both cases, the Ottoman Empire and the contemporary Turkish Republic, you have non-Muslims as well. So to be a Muslim and participate in public square in Turkey is also to recognize that others who aren't Muslims, and some people who are Muslim but don't have Islam as their first point of reference, in other words, secular folks, also participate in the public square in Turkey. So just without expanding your question beyond two examples, Saudi Arabia, which everybody knows is Muslim, and Turkey, which most people know is Muslim but not quite, both of those have a role for religion in public square, but in Saudi Arabia it's dominant, whereas in Turkey, contemporary Turkey, it's competitive with other forces.
Yeah. Well, I suppose that what that does is it serves as a reminder, and we need them, that we have to be very careful when we make sweeping pronouncements about the Muslim world or the Islamic world. And I, of course, I use that terminology. We use that terminology all the time, that you really have to be careful to try to keep in mind that we're talking about different countries with different traditions, and that it's not monolithic. And you, when you ask some kind of question like I did, like, well, what do Muslims think about the role of religion in public life? You have to say, well, what country are you talking about?
Yeah. So, you know, if we were to do this and we were to look at just, you know, France or Italy or Germany and compare them with, let's say, the UK or with the US, you'd have a very different circumstance about what it means to be Roman Catholic in Italy as opposed to Roman Catholic in the U.S. I mean, both, you can say in both countries, actually, it's true, actually, in both countries, Roman Catholics are a majority, but it's a very different sense of what it means to be a Roman Catholic in Italy than to be Roman Catholic in the United States. And that has everything to do with the nature of constitution. And so one of the points that I will be making in the paper that I give at Illinois, which I'm looking forward to doing day after tomorrow, is it's not just a matter of Islam, and it's not just Islam in the public square. There's also this important vehicle, this element that every American knows called the Constitution, but the Constitution is not the same in Turkey, let us say, or in Egypt, another country I hadn't mentioned, but which has majority Muslim. You don't have the same constitution in, let's say, either Turkey or Egypt as you have in the United States. And it does make a difference what the Constitution says, who enforces it, who benefits from it, and who challenges it in every single country. So that, again, it's religion in the public square, but how that religion functions or how people who are people of faith are able to express themselves and what benefits they have in that country in part depends on that constitution.
Mm-hmm. Well, having said that, we're talking about different places and that from place to place there may be different ideas about the extent to which the society should be shaped by religious values, and from place to place we're going to have different ideas about pluralism and whether that's good or not, and we're going to have different ideas about there would be places, you know, like Turkey, for example, where there is the strong secular element, and this idea, at least a lot of people think that that government should be secular. You know, having said all that, is it then really possible to say much about Islam and politics, or in a global sort of way, or are we yet thrown back on the idea that no, you really can't do that? You really have to say, well, where are you talking about?
It's a great question, and I would say the answer to it is, as you might guess, a typical academic question. A typical academic answer to a very potent question would be yes and no. Yes, you can talk about it except with reference to specific countries, but no, there is something beyond these specific countries that is Islam, that relates to Muslim norms and values. And if I had to say what is the glue, you didn't use that metaphor, but I'm using it, glue, what is it that connects religion, Islamist religion in the public domain or public square in all Muslim countries, it's this notion of Sharia. So let me just introduce that word, Sharia, which I think many of your listeners would have heard of before. But Sharia is often falsely translated as simply law, but it's really more like a kind of Emily Post set of norms and values. It's sort of what to do and what not to do. But it is shaped by the ethos and the background and the authority of the Quran, which is the principal scripture in Islam, and then also something that's called tradition or hadith, that's traced back to the sayings and also the conduct and deeds of the Prophet Muhammad. So for people who want to say, what does it mean, not just in one country, whether it's Saudi Arabia or Turkey, or I haven't mentioned Iran, I could mention Iran, Indonesia, also majority, in fact, the largest Muslim country in the world is Indonesia. In all those countries, there are Muslims, and yes, they're shaped by the Constitution, by the constituents of that Constitution, but they're also influenced by the notion of, if you will, a collective Muslim worldview. And if you had to put one word next to that, what is it that is indispensable from a Muslim worldview, it would be the notion of Sharia, or kind of a comprehensive social law.
And would that be, so I feel like I'm getting into some dangerous territory here, but I guess one, we forget that that in the West, Judeo-Christian tradition is embedded in our system of law. I mean, it's there, and some people really like to point to it, and other people like to minimize that, but I don't really think that you can deny that that's there. Is that really so different? Are the two things really so different?
Well, I think what's different when some people say, you know, how do you compare a law, a positive law in the West and Sharia? Sharia is a much more informal set of codified practices that are not rigidly applied in all places, even though some people who are called extremists or fundamentalists think that Sharia means only Islam, means only, for instance, Islamic holidays, just to pick one instance. Only Islamic holidays should be celebrated in a country that follows Sharia, whereas obviously in Turkey and Indonesia and several other Muslim countries, there are celebrations of holy days, holidays, which, of course, is the background for holy days. Holy days or holidays are celebrated that conform to a Christian or, in some cases, also Hindu or Buddhist calendar. So there is a sense in which, you know, the Judeo-Christian background of contemporary law in the West is there, but I don't think there's as direct a connection between those antecedents or, if you will, those influences as there is in what I mentioned as the two sources of scripture in Islam, the Quran as the dominant, most important, and the Hadith or tradition of the Prophet Muhammad as being a complementary support for it.
Our guest in this hour of focus is Bruce Lawrence. He's the inaugural Nancy and Jeffrey Marcus Humanities Professor of Religion at Duke University. He's also now the Associate Director of the Duke Islamic Studies Center and has done a lot of writing and thinking about Islam. And he's rather the country's leading scholars on Islam and one of the people who will be here for a conference taking place on the campus of the University of Illinois, the 16th and 17th, an international symposium that will be looking at Islamic views on salvation. It's titled Islam, Salvation, and the Fate of Others. It's being sponsored by the Department of Religion on the U of I campus, along with some support from other parts of the campus. The lectures are all free and open to the public. This will be taking place at the I Hotel and Conference Center on 1900 South First in Champaign. And maybe the easiest way you can find out more about this, if you'd like, go to the website of the Department of Religion on the campus. I'm sure that you can find information there. Questions are welcome, 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. Email will-talk@illinois.edu. We have a couple of callers here. We'll bring them into the conversation. Again, people can help us keep things moving along by being brief in their comments, but certainly folks are welcome. We'll start up in Geneva, line number 4. Hello.
Good morning. I wanted your opinion on a couple of things. The Constitution here, people seem to want to take the religious part of it out of it. Even though it's been in for millennia, and it seems like there's a conversion from Christianity over to Muslimism, and I was just wondering what you interpret on that. And the other question would be, with all these different religions throughout the world, I've been to several parts of Europe and Asia, and I've yet, everybody treats me as an American with respect, but it seems like when we go over, they come over here, we don't treat them with respect as far as their religion, and everybody's getting hyper about the people wearing the turbans and whatnot. I don't understand that. It's like a, racial profiling. I want your comment on that, and I'll get off. Thank you.
Well, thank you. You actually raised two different questions. First of all, thank you for taking the time and calling in and giving us feedback. And let me answer for first your question about the Constitution and then about headgear and respectful interaction. On the Constitution, you're right. I mean, there are a lot of people who say, that protection of religion means protection from religion. I'm talking about the U.S. context, that somehow religion itself is a nefarious or negative or at least a dubious force in public affairs and you shouldn't have it. Stephen Carter, who writes, teaches rather, and writes from Yale Law School, has indicated, you know, that if you do that, you trivialize religion. That's his category. And I would agree with Professor Carter on that remark, that you can't have just any religion, and you can't have all religion dominating public debate, but you have to have a healthy role for belief in God. As President Eisenhower said, all Americans believe in God. I don't know what that means. You know, and it's sort of a half joke, but it's also half serious, is that the notion that not everybody agrees on who or what or how God is to be thought of, but we do have a slogan called One Nation Under God, not One Nation Under the Hood. And so there's a sense in which the Constitution only protects religion, but states that it should be part of our life. So I would come down saying the U.S. Constitution is misunderstood by those who say, you know, take religion out of it. You can't overemphasize, or you can't dominate one religious view over another, but you can and should include some healthy respect for religion when you think about U.S. Public square and the constitutional provisions for ensuring freedom of speech. Now, on the second question, this is a much more delicate one. It's not a matter of Constitution and how do we think about it, how do we look at it. It's how do we look at other people. So you're asking two different questions, but the second one is, it seems to me, the one that really comes down to the issue about salvation for others, or at least the others as respectfully different but religiously honored in their outlook. And for many Muslims, the way to be honored and the way to project your faith is through a modest wear. So you mentioned turbans. You could have also mentioned scarves or full-body veils, which some Muslim women wear. And the real question for many, and this goes back to Turkey, which we talked about earlier, I talked about earlier with David, in Turkey the notion is that in the public square, the public sphere, in public space, especially in political offices, you cannot have a distinctive religious gear, so that women can't wear scarves, men can't wear turbans or caps that mark them as religious. But in fact, in many other countries, and I could mention Egypt as one, I could mention Indonesia as another, Malaysia as a third, many countries that are majority Muslim in the world, where women do appear in public, do have important jobs, do serve every much as equal citizens and responsibly engaged and employed as men in public jobs, but they dress differently. That is, they do cover, whether they cover their head, as in the case of a man, or in the case of a woman, they cover not only the hair but the full body. And you know, to me, this is a matter of personal preference, religious privilege. It's something that should not be either condemned or restricted by the state.
Well, just to go back real quick and pick up on something that it sounded like the caller was suggesting, and maybe I'm reading something into his comments, but that here in the United States, we certainly have this commitment. We have this strong commitment to the idea of pluralism, and part of that is religious pluralism, and that sometimes we might be there is criticism of majority Muslim countries for failure to have and maintain pluralistic societies. And I think it's perfectly fair to, if you're going to make that criticism, to turn around and look at the United States and say, well, how are we doing?
Yeah. Well, I mean, if that was part of what he was asking is how do we do in upholding our pluralist ideals when we have, of course, now an extension of the State Department that looks at the whole question of religious freedom. And this, by the way, came out under President Clinton, not under the preceding President Bush, that it's a notion that we, the United States, are guardians and protectors and advocates of religious freedom around the world. So then to turn the mirror around and say, how do we practice freedom and pluralism, including religious pluralism in the states, is a fair enough question. And what you were saying is that the caller was saying, and David's following question is asking, how do we grade ourselves in terms of respect for other people's religious traditions? Mm-hmm. And again, I would say it's mixed. I mean, I would say it's mixed in the sense that, you know, in some places it is possible to be confident that however you look and however you worship, that people will accept you. But that's not a given. It's also, by the way, I don't know where the caller has gone, but it's also not a given that everywhere in the Muslim world or in Asia and Africa, with or without dominant Muslim populations, that people are treated equally. There are projections and expectations of what is public dress that people make, and sometimes they're open-ended, and sometimes they're more closed. So, for instance, in Saudi Arabia, a place that I've been often and where I have many friends in close contacts, it's really not comfortable or possible for women, even Western women, even non-Muslim Western women, to go out in public without covering, without wearing a scarf or full-length body covering. So there's a sense in which it really depends, again, on where you are in America and also where you visit overseas as to how comfortable the notion of pluralism is in the public space.
We have to take just a moment here away from our conversation with Bruce Lawrence, and we'll talk some more in a moment with him. He'll be on the campus not very long, I guess, tomorrow and the next day to take part in this conference we've talked about. And we'll, again, give out that basic information to folks who are interested. Also, though, what we're doing here this week, we're carving out some time on our schedule to talk about why supporting the station is so vital. And we know that there are a lot of people who depend on WILL to be there. So when they turn it on, they want there to be focus. They want there to be Morning Edition. They want there to be All Things Considered. And one of the things we like about working on this station is we just do our jobs. And we're trying to bring the program to people, and we don't interrupt it with anything. We just do the job. But occasionally, we have to sit here in front of the microphones and say, look, folks, the reason that we can do this without commercials, this is, after all, non-commercial radio, the reason we can do it is that people who listen and who like the shows also help to pay for them. That is what you're doing when you call and make a contribution or you go online and make a contribution. And we found here that one of the best ways we can encourage people to support the station is to ask. Just sit here in front of the microphones and ask. And so a couple of times a year we do. So if you've been thinking about that, if you're not a supporter, if you are a listener but you're not a supporter, we hope that you will call, you will go online, and you can do that today and help us meet our overall goal of supporting the station. Here in the studio with me is Dave Teal. He's the program director for our TV station, WILL-TV.
And good morning. It's good to be back. And we really would like to encourage you right now, if you're listening to this program, to give us a call at 217-244-9455 with your financial contribution. Times are tough for an awful lot of people. And certainly here in the state of Illinois, there's a lot of agencies and organizations that have seen some pretty massive cuts in their state funding. We have been no exception to that. We've taken a loss of about 50% this year that was, you know, really unexpected. And we're looking at the possibility of further cuts in the future. We've had to make some cuts of our own here in response to that. And that is, it's not a situation anybody is happy about. And it's certainly something that we don't want to ever have to do again. And that's where you come in right now with your phone call, 217-244-9455. As state money dries up, and we have no reason to believe it won't continue to do so in the future, you are going to become ever more important. So 217-244-9455 is the number to call with your pledge of financial support this morning. It really is vital that we hear from you. Don't put it off.
And we'll continue now our conversation with the guest for this hour of Focus, Bruce Lawrence. He is going to be taking part in a symposium that's sponsored in part by the Department of Religion here at the U of I, Islam, Salvation, and the Fate of Others. Some of the world's leading scholars of Islam will be here at the university tomorrow and the next day for this symposium. All of these lectures are free and open to the public. It's happening at the I Hotel and Conference Center on South First in Champaign. And if you'd like to find out more, probably the easiest thing to do would be to go to the website of the Department of Religion and look at the schedule there. And, of course, questions here in this hour of Focus are completely welcome as well. 333-9455 is the number here in Champaign-Urbana. Toll-free, 800-222-9455. For people who would be making a long-distance call, the email is will-talk@illinois.edu. Our guest, Bruce Lawrence, is professor of religion at Duke University. He is also the associate director of the Duke Islamic Studies Center and is author of a number of books about Islam. And questions here certainly are welcome. Well, we get back to the phones here. We have a caller in Effingham. We'll go to them next on our line number one. Hello.
Yes.
Just an aside, David. I have payroll deduction, and each month I pay my share.
Well, we appreciate it.
Yes. So my question is, your guest, I have a question in three parts. He said created equal. Well, what does that word mean, created? You know, in a religious sense, there's a whole bunch of stuff that's piled on top of that. The next thing is, and I'd like to hang on, how does misogynism, misanthropy, and obedience play into religious dogma, and how that is acted out around the world? We're still stacked in layers, and women on the bottom, children mean nothing. The object is power. And can you give me an answer to my first question and how the others play in?
Yeah, so all your questions. Thank you, first of all. I should say on behalf of David and WIL, thank you for having the monthly payroll deduction that helps their program. But secondly, for your question in three parts, yes, there is the notion in Islam, as there is in Christianity and also Judaism. And I've studied other religions, Buddhism, Hinduism, Sikhism, almost every ism I know. There's a notion that I guess the best one is, of course, the one that comes out of Confucius, the yin and the yang, that you can't have one without the other, you know, and that there's a sense in which men and women are not only created equal, but they're the complementary aspect of all creation, without which there would not be the world that we know or the possibility for its future. So it's not just a Christian or even an Abrahamic or differently spoken in Arabic rather than in English, a metaphor for Islam, but it's for all religions that men and women are supposed to have shared and complementary and equivalent, if not equal, roles in this world. But your second part is equally true, that there has not been in the history of the world a fair shake, the equivalent attention or justice for women that there is for men. And that has been true for the so-called West, for Europe, and also the United States for much of our history until very, very recently. And you could say, well, and it still hasn't happened yet in the Muslim world. And I would say yes. Again, going back to David's first point, if you look at the Muslim world as a whole, you could say there are many, many parts where all those bad things you mentioned that suggest a power relationship bordering on, if not actually expressive of misogyny and deprecation of women and women's roles, you could say that goes on. But you could equally say, and I think it's really important to note, that within the whole spectrum of its history, the Muslim world, again, going back to the Sharia, this notion that there is a certain common set of moral codes and values for Muslims, if you go back to its origin in the 7th century, the Prophet Muhammad, who is the mediating point for what became Islamic scripture, the Quran or Koran, was himself, a pioneer for advocating better attention. I won't say equal attention, but better attention to women than to men. And you say, well, that still doesn't pass the test of equality. But if you consider that he existed and the Quran was revealed in a society where it was not infrequent for baby girls to be killed because they were not considered to be as economically useful as baby boys. Now, take a look at the world today. There was a headline feature cover on the Economist, I believe, in the last month, which said, what happened to all the missing women? And the missing women were not from Muslim countries. There were some Muslim countries, but China and India, which China has a very small Muslim population. India has a minority Muslim population. But in both of those countries, the missing women, if you trace it back, were women who were not allowed to have full life. In other words, I'm talking about women who were denied the possibility of life at birth. And so this is not simply a Muslim problem. And it is one that pervades pre-modern cultures, but even modern-day cultures. We're now in the 21st century. And this feature essay and review and also criticism that came out in The Economist came out just last month. So there are many better things that could be done, many things that have been done in some Muslim countries to ensure a better role for women than men. I mean, to give you one instance that most people sort of ignore, there have been women last time I checked, there has not been a woman president of the United States, but there have been women prime ministers in Muslim countries. And in fact, there's a sitting one now in Bangladesh, which is the third largest Muslim country in the world. So in terms of having women in the public square, women acknowledged as politically valuable, valid, and authoritative figures, they exist in the Muslim world, arguably to the same extent or even better than in some non-Muslim countries. It doesn't mean that the situation is ideal or that couldn't be better, but simply that the slogan which you started out with, created equal, our men and women create equal, is a theological postulate that practically has not been implemented in most societies. Some Muslim societies have failed, but some other non-Muslim societies have failed even worse.
Yes, and I would like to follow up. You didn't mention the third thing of obedience, which is a huge requirement of all religion, to oneself or to the dogma. How is it that God, in the minds of all humans that are able to understand language and speech, is a male? How do we get there?
Yeah, actually, you touched on a very important issue when you said obedience is crucial to the dogma of all religions. And I'm going to presuppose at least some of our listeners are Christian, and that if I quoted the Lord's Prayer and the part of it that says, thy will be done, that in fact is an invocation for obedience. It's not my will. It's not the collective will. It's not our will. It's thy will. This is from the first part of the Lord's Prayer, common, I think, for every Christian, no matter what her or his stripe. So the notion that there's obedience to a higher power and it's thy will, not my will, be done, is intrinsic. And what has happened over time is that it's the prerogative of men to say, not only do one obey God, but one obeys God's servants, and the primary people who take that role of being divine servants, otherwise known as religious officials, are male. So it is part and parcel of a social condition that has turned what is a theological postulate into an institutional practice. Not to be justified, I'm in the brigade of those that are called male feminists. I don't like the term, but I think it translates into men who believe that women deserve and should have every opportunity for the same space and the same opportunities and the same outcomes as men.
I want to thank the caller, and I need to jump in because here we are headed into about our last 10 minutes of the program, and I'd like to see if there are other folks who'd like to join in or other questions they'd like to pose. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455, email will-talk@illinois.edu. I wanted to maybe ask a little bit different question. In the beginning, I tried to pose this question about, well, what for the individual citizen, what does his faith, you're talking about Islam, what does that have to say about, say, the rights and responsibilities of the citizen? In a larger sort of sense, does it say something about what are the rights and particularly the responsibilities of governments toward their citizens?
Yeah, a very apt question, and going back to your very first question, it's a general question when you invoke individual Muslim citizen and talk about rights and responsibilities. There are patterns of this that vary from Dakar in Senegal, which is a majority Muslim country in West Africa, to Jakarta, which happens to be the capital of Indonesia, way out in Southeast Asia. And, you know, there are 57 majority Muslim countries, and there are another 14 with substantial Muslim minorities. So, you know, in trying to generalize about 71 countries, it'd be hard to say there's one pattern or one prescribed norm for individual Muslim citizen. But on your flip side of the government, what does the government state and what does the government expect? I would say that the one thing that is really consistent across the board is the notion that Islam would be honored in public through, obviously, institutions of worship like the mosque and also educational institutions like the madrasa or university. In fact, the universities we know in the West traces back to the madrasa system that comes from the Muslim world of Baghdad and Andalus in Spain. But the whole then further notion is that the government must also provide services, and the services include the same things as any government in the world would have to provide for the basic health, housing, welfare, and education of its own citizens. The difference in the Muslim would be that in the Muslim or majority Muslim country is that there would be also provisions for inheritance, for marriage, and for divorce that rely on a tradition going back not to the 7th century but to the 9th century when Muslim laws became more or less solidified. And those are distinctive to Muslim citizens in a way that differentiates from non-Muslims. So I think that's a major difference. It's not that there is any less of an overall sense of reciprocity. The usual word is reciprocity. That is to say that the citizens have responsibilities for the government. The government has certain duties, rights that it has to guarantee the citizens. So that reciprocity is common to all polities. The United Nations has, last time I checked, about 192 flags, and in each one of those countries, no matter what the flag and no matter what the breakout of the religious loyalty of the population, there has to be this same. Burma, Myanmar obviously does a less careful job than would Morocco in providing for its citizens, but Myanmar and Morocco each fly a flag in the United Nations, and both are supposed to have constitutions that guarantee rights but also expect responsibilities from their citizens.
Hmm. We have two callers here, and I'd like to try to get them both in the time that remains. We'll go first to Urbana in line one. Hello.
Hello. The Muslim contention that dogs are unclean may have been apt in its day. They may have had some type of communicable disease, but nowadays we see dogs as leaders are for the blind, assistants to physically impaired people. They can sniff out bombs, and there are other purposes for them as well.
Well, is
so
that something
somebody who owns a dog and is a great canine advocate, I'm not going to put my passion for dogs on the same level as my passion for women, for women's rights, but I will say that in the same way that women have had an improved and I would think a steadily better visibility and opportunity in most Muslim countries, I can tell you there are also some Muslim countries where dogs are not seen as unclean but welcome. The one animal that you're not going to find too much in presence is pigs. So dogs may have a better future, but I think pigs are going to continue to be considered unclean and unapproachable for Muslims, as of course they also are for Jews. So my simple answer is I hope dogs fare better, and I'm sorry I can't say the same for pigs.
All right, let's go to another caller here. This is Champagne Line 2. Hello.
Hi. I tuned in late, so you might have dealt with these questions, but I'll bring up two questions that I have. The first has to do with the attitude of Muslims towards areas that they conquer, which had previous religious traditions and which they now essentially say those traditions have no legitimacy, such as we could pick one is we could talk about Afghanistan and Pakistan, which used to be primarily Buddhist and Hindu. The most egregious example of that recently is the bombing of the Buddhas in Bamiyan.
Right.
But this extends to issues in Turkey with the Sophia Cathedral and the fact that it's now become a museum, but religious worship there is not welcomed. It extends to the issues on Temple Mount, which some Muslims want to deny there ever was a temple there, except that Muslim tradition also has that that's part of the reason why Muhammad supposedly went to heaven from there. But the fact that they now want to, there is a movement to deny that aspect. The same with the cave of the patriarchs in Hebron. So the issue is the legitimacy of the pre-Muslim societies, because once, and it also was an issue in India with the Muslim mosque and Hindu temple. The second issue, and I'll say it quickly, has to do with the application of Sharia law on non-Muslims, or even on Muslims who don't want to follow it, especially now in the West. But you also have it in Turkey, and issues of Muslims who convert to Christianity, or the Muslim enclaves in the West, both in Western Europe and even in the United States, where there's an attempt to enforce Muslim laws, whether in the forms where they come with honor killings, or even in terms of how one is legitimately to dress, whether issues of pork, as you say, and wine. So I'll just stop there, let you talk about this.
Those are two very excellent and complicated questions, and we really only have about 3-4 minutes, so you can take them on as best as you can.
Well, yeah, first of all, I want to thank the caller, and if he's not Jewish, I apologize for thinking he is, because I've never met anybody who knows as much about some of these places as he does, especially the ones that he mentioned in Jerusalem, but also the encyclopedic fact world. I thought at one point I was listening to Wikipedia, and I say it in a complimentary sense, I use Wikipedia. So that I want to thank the caller for the range of questions on two essential points, if I can summarize them without giving all the wonderfully rich anecdotes that he gave. The attitude of Muslims towards countries that they conquer, which in every case, by the way, from the beginning, Muslims conquered countries that where there were not Muslims, because Muslims initially were limited to Saudi Arabia, or what's called the Saudi Arabia today, the Arabian Peninsula, and also a small part of Ethiopia, where Muslims went in 615 when they thought they were going to be exterminated in their hometown of Mecca. And then the second question, which the viewer very helpfully raised, was the notion of how does Sharia apply not only to non-Muslims, but also, in a certain sense, to Muslims who would rather be exempt from it and not be bound by it, whether they're in the West or in their own host countries. So this is a very important, both questions. Then let me answer them quickly because we don't have much time. The attitude of Muslims varies enormously about conquest, but Egypt I would pick up. Egypt is one of the countries I'm going to talk about extensively when I'm in Illinois 24 hours from now. And Egypt is a country where, when you look at it, there were, of course, a lot of Christians and also, by the way, Jews. And both Christians and Jews continued to live in Egypt until very recently. I'm sure the caller knows the history of the exodus of Jews from Egypt to Israel following the creation of Israel in the late 40s. But the whole larger history of both Jews and Christians in Egypt is defined as something that is called the Ahl-Dhimma, the people who are considered to be minorities who are non-Muslim, who have to pay a special tax called jizya, J-I-Z-Y-A, but are otherwise treated with respect and able to have some but not all positions in public space. So it's not the same thing as citizenship, and I've written about this to say it is not equivalent to say someone's a dhimmi and someone is a citizen. But by the way, Egyptian Muslims and Egyptian Christians, otherwise known as Copts, have also written about this. The litmus test, or if you will, the biggest historical case for how Muslims treat both Christians and Jews, not only respectfully, but fully engaging them in the public sphere, is Al-Andalus, or Muslim Spain. And when the Catholics reconquered Spain at the end of the 15th century before Columbus sailed to this country, it was Jews who were expelled first, but Muslims right after that. And the Jewish dispersion that went across North Africa and, of course, ended up with a lot of Jews also in the Ottoman Empire was a result not of Muslim persecution, but unfortunately of Christian, specifically Catholic expulsion. So there's a range of attitudes. I'm not saying it's good in every case and that I would defend it in every case, but I would say about the Temple of the Mount, most of the Muslims whom I know not only recognize and respect the fact that the Temple of the Mount, but also that this whole space called the Haram al-Sharif is shared by Jews, Christians, and Muslims, and should continue to be so going forward. So on the Sharia, because I've only got about a minute now for the Sharia. So the Sharia and the attitude towards non-Muslims, again, there's this notion that there's a dhimmi, the people who are protected because they are what's called Ahlul Kitab. They're people of the book. And the book doesn't mean it's only the Quran. The book in a Muslim worldview, and I'm not saying all Muslims accept anywhere that all Jews or Christians accept the higher theological dictates of their religions, but the one that is out there that is normative is the book is not the Quran. The book is a larger, if you will, celestial scroll that includes the Torah, observed by Jews, Zabur, or Psalms, which is also part of both Jewish and Christian observance, and, of course, the Injil or Gospel, which is peculiar or reserved for Christians. But in a Muslim worldview, all those are scriptures, and in many cases, people think also should include Buddhist sutras and also the epics of Hinduism. But there is a sense in which the Sharia is a flexible, as I said before, it's not a fixed code, it's a flexible, ongoing set of rules, and that it should accommodate non-Muslims, and also allow exceptions for Muslims who don't want to be part of it.
Yeah. You know, we have a way on this program of taking on big, complicated topics, so we come to the end, and I often find myself saying, I wish we had more time, but we have to stop. And that's what I'm going to say right now. We've come to the end. However, for people who are listening here in Champaign-Urbana, our guest for this hour of the show, Bruce Lawrence, will be one of a number of very important scholars of Islam that will be here for an international symposium tomorrow and the next day exploring Islamic views on salvation. There are many co-sponsors, but the main sponsor is the Department of Religion here at the University of Illinois, Islam, Salvation, and the Fate of Others. And as I mentioned earlier, probably the easiest way to get information about it, if you'd like to find out what's going on, is go to the website of the Department of Religion. All of the lectures associated with this are free and open to the public. They'll be taking place at the I Hotel and Conference Center on South First in Champaign. Our guest, Bruce Lawrence, teaches at Duke, where he is the Associate Director of the Duke Islamic Studies Center. And Professor Lawrence, thank you very much.
Thank you, David, and thank you for all your wonderful callers.
We have a minute or two here before we turn things over to Celeste Quinn to remind folks that this station survives and is strong and is commercial free because listeners support it with their dollars. If you tune in for conversations like this, the other things that we do here on Focus, or if you listen in for commodity market information, or if you listen for the international news that comes with the BBC, or the news programs that we have in the morning and the afternoon, all of these shows, they need your financial support. We got to pay the bills, keep the place open. We got to pay for the NPR programs we air. You can make that possible right now very easily by going to the telephone and dialing 244-9455 and making a pledge. Dave Teal is here with me in the studio. He's the program director for WILL Television.
Yes, and we really do. We want to get you on the phone right now. Look, I mean, I've hosted this program a handful of times, and I know there's a great deal of work that goes into it. David has to read an awful lot of books to make this show happen. And, you know, and I don't mean to make that sound like a bad thing, but it is just a lot of preparation. In fact, I heard as our previous guest in the previous hour had left, you know, he was complimenting David on just, you know, the amount of preparation he'd done for the interview. And I know David does that for all of them. And it is a great deal of work that goes into this program. We hope that you appreciate that effort and that you will support it this morning with your phone call, 217-244-9455.
Well, the thing that I will say is that I feel lucky that we, on the program, we have a lot of really good guests.
Yeah.
And people who are really interesting folks who have knowledge on just about everything that you could possibly imagine. And we're lucky that being here at the university, we have a lot of people who come here, like the first hour guest, and we can have them physically in the studio. And then, of course, anybody who is interested in being on the show and has a telephone, we can do that too. And we've tried to cover a very wide range of subject matter. And that's one of the things I think people have said they really appreciate, that there are so many different – you never know what you're going to get when you tune in for the show.
Yeah. And I mean, I just feel like I know, you know, the kind of topics I've covered. You've got to be a real Renaissance man. I mean, just from thousands of things that you've had to cover on this show. And I do, you know, I just realize I want to recognize that effort. And just I think we hear that all the time, that people always are kind of surprised at how much preparation is done for these interviews. And I get the feeling that other people are perhaps not quite so prepared.
Yeah, maybe. Well, and also I think we also have to acknowledge the fact that I think the callers really add a lot to the show, because they're also smart and curious people. And that's one of the things that I think over the years has set the show a little bit apart, quality of guests and the quality of callers. So anyway, if you've been a caller, if you're a listener, and if you're not a supporter, now's the time to change that. You can do it really easily by calling us, by going online.
Yeah, right, exactly. It's willpledge.org or, of course, 217-244-9455. Don't put it off. Tomorrow is, well, this is one of the last days here of this pledge drive, and we want to hear from you right now.
All right.